Today is not going to be a typical message with 3 points and a very nice outline. You wouldn't get that very often here anyway. Today is going to be more like a camp talk, because I've been out at camp a couple weeks this summer, and I just got home yesterday, or Friday I should say, from boys camp. So I'm kind of in the routine of, or in the mindset of a camper. Today I would like to talk to you about forgiveness. At the top of your page, however you want to lay this thing out on your page, I want you to consider for about 10 or 15 seconds one person or a family maybe or a group of people that you have had a hard time letting go of bitterness, anger, resentment. Maybe it's a parent. Maybe it's a sibling. Maybe it's someone else that you served with in a church or at work. But I want you to think of one person's name, and I want you to write their name down. You don't have to show your neighbor. I want you to think about this for a little bit and write down the name of one person that you're having a hard time forgiving. And I'm going to use the story of Joseph. Most of us know who Joseph was in the Old Testament. And if you'd like to turn back to Genesis 37, we're going to spend most of our time in Genesis. And I've decided that I'm not going to read it verbatim, because it's not quite as concise, I should say, because we've only got a few minutes here left. So I'm going to try to give an overview or summary of what happened in Joseph's life. So we're going to start in Genesis 37, verse 2. And we're going to talk about this guy named Joseph. Verse 2. This is the account of Jacob. Joseph, his 17-year-old son, was taking care of the flocks with his brothers. Now he was a youngster working with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his father's wives. Joseph brought back a bad report for them to their father. Now, before we get too into this, I want you to think about the state, the age that Joseph was at this point. It says he's 17, he's pretty young. He doesn't have a whole lot of experience under his belt. And let's read verse 4. Skip down to verse 4. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father loved him more than any of them, they hated Joseph and were not able to speak to him kindly. So the picture that we're seeing here is that Joseph was young. He was 17 years old. All the other brothers are working out on the field, tending to the flock, the sheep. And then he says something about Joseph being the father's favorite son. Their father's name is Jacob, and Jacob was later referred to as Israel. So if you see, if we're reading along here and it says Israel, that's Jacob, okay? God had given him a new name, and that he ends up being the father of Israel, the nation, the group of people. Let's go down to verse 5. So we've got this young guy who's 17. His brothers hate him because he's their dad's favorite, right? So verse 5. Joseph had a dream, and when he told his brothers about it, they hated him even more. Now, I'm going to summarize his dream. He had a dream that, after it was interpreted, it basically meant that his brothers were going to bow down and worship him, or bow down to honor him as some sort of a ruling authority over them. And they were going to pay homage to him. And of course, that made them hate him even more, right? I mean, have you ever had a sibling that was maybe preferred over you, or at least you think they might have been preferred over you, and that resentment that you kind of, oh, I don't feel so good about this, right? Well, you can imagine what Joseph's brothers felt. And there was quite a bit of a harsh feeling. So let's go down to verse 8. Then his brothers asked him, "Do you really think you will rule over us or have a dominion over us?" They hated him even more because of his dream and because of what he said. He had a dream that they would at some point bow to him and that he will have authority over them. And he explained it to his brothers, and they hated him for it, even more so than what they did before. So one day, Jacob sent Joseph out to check on his brothers and the flocks that they had in the fields. And that goes down to verse 18. Now Joseph's brothers saw him from a distance, and before he reached them, they plotted to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes his master of This master of dreams is what they call them. Come now, let's kill him, throw him into one of the cisterns, which is like an empty hole in the ground sort of thing, and then say that a wild animal ate him. Then we'll see how his dreams turn out. So they were going to kill him or throw him in this pit. Verse 21. When Reuben heard this, he rescued Joseph from their hands, saying, let's not take his life. Reuben continued, don't shed blood. Throw him into the cistern that is here in the wilderness, but don't lay a hand on him. Reuben said this so he could rescue Joseph from them and take him back to his father. So one of the brothers felt a little bit of compassion for him. When Joseph reached his brothers, they stripped him of his tunic, the special tunic that he wore, which was made by their father. Then they took him and threw him into the cistern. Now the cistern was empty. There was no water in it. Verse 25. When they sat down to eat their food, they looked up and saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead. Their camels were carrying spices, balm, and myrrh down to Egypt. Then Judah, which is one of the brothers, said to his brothers, what profit is it if we kill our brother and cover up his blood? Come, let's sell him to the Ishmaelites, but let's not lay a hand on him, for after all, he is our brother. So let's make some money off of this kid, because it's better than just killing him and let his blood, just seep into the ground. Let's get some money out of him, right? He is our own flesh. The brothers agreed. So when Midianite merchants passed by, Joseph's brothers pulled him out of the cistern and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver. The Ishmaelites then took Joseph to Egypt. So basically, we see Joseph being sold into slavery by his own brothers because of their hatred. Let's go ahead and skip over to chapter 39. Now, I'll give you a couple of details here that we're going to skip over, but are important to know. In Egypt, he became a servant of Potiphar, and Potiphar was one of the high-ups in the government of Egypt. He wasn't the main ruler, but he was one of the top rulers of Egypt. And he ends up in Potiphar's house, and he works his way up to being one of the top servants in Potiphar's house, because there was just something about this kid, Joseph. There was something about his demeanor, maybe his work ethic, maybe just some aura about him that he was a hard worker, and he ended up working his way up into the service of Potiphar and making it to one of the top servants in Potiphar's house, or if not the top. And let's start in verse 1. Now Joseph had been brought down to Egypt. An Egyptian named Potiphar, an official of Pharaoh and the captain of the guard, purchased him from the Ishmaelites who had brought him there. The Lord was with Joseph. He was successful and lived in the household of the Egyptian master. His master observed that the Lord was with him and that the Lord had made everything he was doing successful. So Joseph found favor in his sight and became his personal attendant. Potiphar appointed Joseph overseer of his household and put him in charge of everything he owned. So Joseph basically was the top kid in charge of this house, right? He was overseeing everything. And I'm not going to get into the details here, but you probably know Potiphar's wife struck a fancy for Joseph. He was good looking, it says, young, strapping. I think my translation says well built. So he's probably buff, attractive to her. And she pursued to have a relationship with him. And it wasn't just once, it was over and over. And every time he said, no, I can't do this, because Potiphar put me in charge of everything in his house. He respects me and honors me enough that he lets me have authority in his house over everything, but I will not disrespect him by sleeping with his wife. And he kept telling her this, I'm not going to do this. Well, we all know that one day, of course, she was very persistent, and he finally said no again, and she took his coat or his tunic, and as she grabbed it, he ran off, and then when he ran off, she started screaming, guards, guards, he tried to take advantage of me, rape, for lack of better terms. And of course, Potiphar heard about this. The guards ended up finding him and grabbing him, and instead of giving him a fair trial or at least hearing him out, you got to take the word of your wife, at least that's what Potiphar thought, and he ended up putting Joseph in jail, in prison. So Joseph goes to prison for something that he didn't do. Now let's go ahead and skip down to chapter 40, verse 1. There are two other inmates in this prison with him. One of them was the former cupbearer, and a cupbearer is kind of like a secret service agent. But what he does is when food is brought out or wine is brought out to Potiphar or the Pharaoh or one of the high-ranking officials, I think in this instance it was Pharaoh, when somebody would bring food to Pharaoh that had been prepared for him, they would have somebody who would test the wine first, test the food first, and they called it the cupbearer because it would be the person that brought the cup to Pharaoh, tried it, and he didn't die. Okay, it must be okay for Pharaoh, right? He didn't get sick, he didn't die, didn't have convulsions. So this is the cupbearer. The other person that was in the prison with him, among others probably, but one other main person was the baker, the master baker, it says in my translation. He was probably the top baker for Pharaoh. So Pharaoh's got this, it's kind of like the president, right? He's got, I think the president's kitchen is downstairs in the basement, if I remember correctly. And so he's got this group of people working for him, and I don't know what Pharaoh's palace quite looked like as far as the kitchen and stuff goes, but I do know that he had quite a few people. But this was the master baker. And the master baker and the cupbearer were both thrown in prison, probably because somebody tried to poison Pharaoh. I'm just guessing. There's probably some evidence in there about that. But the point is that one day the cupbearer said, I had a dream. And he didn't know what it meant. So he's telling Joseph, one of the other inmates, he says, my dream about this and this, and he explains to him the dream, and he goes, I have no idea what this means. And Joseph says, I know what that means. I can interpret dreams. Joseph said, that means that you, in the next 3 days, are going to go back to the palace and be serving Pharaoh. You're going to be released from prison, and you're going to go back into the service of Pharaoh. Oh, great, fantastic. And then he said, when you do, remember me. When you go back, you tell Pharaoh that I've got this gift of interpreting dreams. The other guy, the master baker, comes and he says, you know, I had a very similar dream, but it was different. And so he explains to Joseph his dream. And he says, oh, man, I don't know if, you know, I could imagine Joseph saying, well, I know what it means. I don't know if I want to tell you, but I'm going to tell you anyway. It means that pretty much in 3 days, you're going to be beheaded. That was the interpretation of the dream. Well, 3 days happened. The cupbearer was put back into the service of the Pharaoh, and the master baker was beheaded and killed, executed. So what happened? The cupbearer went back to the service of Pharaoh and completely forgot about Joseph. Oh, I forgot, the guy that told me the dream, right? The interpretation of the dream. He completely forgot. So he went back to working for Pharaoh and totally neglected what Joseph had asked him to do. A few years later, I think it says 2 years later, let's go to chapter 41, verse 1. I think it says a couple years later. Let's see here. At the end of 2 full years, Pharaoh had a dream. So Pharaoh had this dream, and he's asking all of his wise men and his sorcerers and his priests of these pagan religions and stuff, whatever sort of faith they had back then. He's asking them, I had this dream about 7 cows that were healthy cows, and then 7 cows that were not so healthy, they were sickly, and they ended up eating up the 7 healthy cows. Kind of a gross picture that he's painting in his dream. And he says, I don't know what this means. What does this mean? And all of his wise people, his advisors, his pagan priests, and all of these sorcerers had no answer for him. And he was at his wit's end. I had this dream. I don't know what and it's really bugging me. I can't figure this out. Well, the cupbearer says, you know, that reminds me of this character I met back in prison. So it reminds him of Joseph. And he says, you know, you should go talk to this guy, Joseph. He's in your jail down there. You got to go get him up here and tell him, because he interpreted my dream, and it was right, and he interpreted the master baker's dream, and unfortunately it was correct too, and he might be able to help you. So Pharaoh calls down for Joseph, and he says, okay, I've got this dream. And he talked about the seven cows that were healthy and the seven cows that were not healthy. And Joseph says, I know exactly what this means. The seven healthy cows are 7 years of really, really good harvest of food. And the seven unhealthy cows that were sickly, those are 7 years of bad harvest and bad food growth, famine, and they're going to totally eat up the seven good years. And it's going to make the seven good years seem like a distant past. And so Pharaoh said, well, that doesn't sound so good to me. What should we do? And Joseph says, well, you know, if you were wise, you'd probably save up some food from the good 7 years. You save them up, you build these storage units for the grain and for whatever other food, the crop that they were getting, and let's store them so that a percentage of it, so that we will have food during the seven bad years. That's kind of saving it for a rainy day, sort of a rainy day account or fund that we would consider, but it's in food this time. And of course, Pharaoh's like, these, for lack of better terms, these idiots behind here couldn't figure out what my dreams were about. I don't trust any of them to run this. Who could I trust to run such a huge operation? Because if it's what you say it's going to be, it's going to affect everybody in this region, this famine will. So of course, who better than the guy who interpreted the dream? Joseph. So Joseph becomes the one that manages this whole system of storing up for the rainy sea or for rainy day, although it probably was the opposite for them. So Joseph becomes the one that's in charge. And in fact, it says he's second in command only to Pharaoh because he's overseeing such a huge task of storing up food and then having a system of doling it out for the people. Let's go ahead to go to chapter 42. I really encourage you guys to read this. I'm not reading very many of the verses because I'm trying to give you a bigger overview of everything without getting too into the verses. But if you have a time this week, I would really, really recommend reading from Genesis 37 all the way to Genesis 45. And there's a couple chapters in there that don't have to deal with this story that are or sections that are about something else that you could probably just overlook. I think one chapter in general or in particular that you could just skim through it because it's not really about the story. Okay, so Joseph had been put in charge of managing the harvest and storage part of it. So verse 1 of chapter 42, when Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt. Now back up, remember who Jacob was. Jacob's the father of Joseph, who thinks that Joseph's dead, right? So when Jacob heard there was grain in Egypt, he said to his sons, why are you looking at each other? Then he said, look, I hear that there is grain in Egypt. Go down there and buy grain for us so that we may live and not die. So they were starving up there in Canaan, the land of Canaan. So 10 of Joseph's brothers went down to buy grain from Egypt. But Jacob did not send Joseph's brother Benjamin with his brothers. For he said, what if some accident happens to him? So Israel's, which is Jacob's sons came to buy grain among other travelers, for the famine was severe in the land of Canaan. So 10 of Jacob's sons start off for Egypt. They get to Egypt, and immediately Joseph knows who they are. Now, there could be a lesson here about being honest up front and not manipulating the situation, but that's not the lesson I'm going to get into. But there's a fair amount of manipulation going on Jacob's part, but basically he knows exactly who they are. And he starts engaging them in conversation through a translator because he acts like he can't understand them. And there's a comment in there that says that he knew exactly what they were saying, even though he was using a translator to act like he didn't know. And basically he engages them in a conversation, finds out that there's another brother that was actually a child of his mother. So they were actual full blood brothers, for lack of better terms. And he said, well, where is that kid? And they said, well, he's kind of our father's favorite, and he feared for his safety. And then they mentioned, well, there's another brother, but he's not alive anymore, which is referring to Joseph. or he's gone, or something to that effect. And so Joseph says, I think you're here to just spy on us. You're here to spy out the land so you could take our food and cause war on us, and you're going to take it, you're going to cause problems. And they said, no, we're not spies. We're not here to do this. We're sincerely hungry. We're giving you our whole story. And he says, well, if this is true, I'm going to, and there's a couple little details that we're skipping here that are minor details. I really encourage you to read it. He says, okay, if this is true, I want you to go back. I'm going to hold one of you in prison. I want you, the other nine of you, to go back and tell your father to send Benjamin, the youngest son, because if your story doesn't add up, you're spies. But if it adds up, then I'll release everybody and everything will be good and you can buy some food. Because I think he wanted to see his younger brother. So he manipulated this whole thing so that he could see his younger brother. So they go back, they tell Jacob what's going on, and Jacob's like, you can't take Benjamin, you can't take Benjamin. Of course, he's got another son that's sitting in prison back in Egypt, but you can't take Benjamin. You can't, okay, fine, you can take Benjamin. So he takes Benjamin, they take Benjamin back, and they bring them before Joseph. It's quite emotional. Joseph almost breaks into tears right in front of them. He turns away and he runs back into the back. And of course, it says that he wept. He cried and cried and cried and cried. He comes back out. It says he washes his face off, because you can imagine the red, blotchy tears coming down. He comes out, washes his face off, comes out and talks to him. And a couple other kind of manipulative things happen. But in the end, they find out that that's Joseph. That's the brother that they sold into slavery. And what Joseph does in the end is he invites his whole family through Pharaoh's okay, or Pharaoh's invitation. He invites his family to come and move down into the most beautiful place in Egypt. It's called Goshen or something, or Goshen. Goshen. And it's like, I tried to think about what it would be like in Portland, and I'm thinking maybe Lake Oswego. You know, the upper, oh, we have people laughing over here. Or maybe the west side, where there's a fair amount of money out there. This is the type of area Goshen was in Egypt. It isn't just Gresham. You know, it's not like Rockwood and Gresham. It's more like Persimmons would be considered in Gresham. This is the place where the upper crust of Egypt lived. Because it was beautiful land, it was a lot of rich with food, and the people were higher class. And this is the place where Joseph brought his family to live. The 10 brothers that sold him into slavery. And of course, the brother that was younger, Benjamin. And then he brings up his father, Jacob, and his father comes to Egypt. And this is, of course, the beginning of where Israel is now in Egypt. And of course, we know 400 years, something years later, we know that Moses had to lead them out of Israel. But this is the beginning of it. And the lesson that I want to bring out of this, the picture that I want to bring out of this, is the forgiveness that had to go on between Joseph and his brothers. And also Joseph and Potiphar's wife. If you're going to serve under the Pharaoh, unless Potiphar got in trouble and was chastised for it, he had to come to grips in prison. He was in there for at least a couple years. He had to come to grips with forgiveness. God's biggest goal, I think, for everybody is reconciliation. Why did he send Christ down to die for us? So that he could reconcile us back to the Father. So in reconciliation, you have one party over here and you have one party over here. And there's a huge problem between them. Maybe a disagreement. Maybe somebody owes somebody money. Maybe somebody did something to offend the other party. Reconciliation is the process of bringing the two parties together and bringing them back into friendship, to relationship together. I think that is, in the end, what happened with Joseph and his brothers. They lived and Goshen, the nicest area of Egypt, because Joseph forgave them. I want to mention a few verses before we wrap up here. Some translations use the word remission Anybody use the King James here? One, two. We have two people who use the King James, maybe a couple more, maybe. They use the word remission. The word remission is probably more accurate than forgiveness. Because in remission, they're basically interchangeable words that in the English language could probably be used. Either one of them could be used and it'd be accurate. But remission gives you a sense of, I no longer see the debt. I no longer see the penalty or the issue. When you have a gulf between God and man, just like Joseph and his brothers, there's the issue that's there. Forgiveness gives you a sense that I see what you did wrong to me, but I'm going to choose to overlook it. Remission means I don't even see what you did wrong to me anymore. And in remission, there's always a price. Remission comes at a price. For without the shedding of blood, there is no remission. Remission comes with a price. So while we use the word forgive, understand that it means that it costs something. We're not just overlooking something. If you truly want to remit someone from something that they've done, forgive them in the furthest sense of the word. You can't just go, well, I'm looking at what you did and I'm choosing to overlook it at this point, but I'm not going to forget. And then you hold on to that. Because that's not remission. That's sort of pseudo-forgiveness. There's a couple of verses in the New Testament that give us a good picture of how to forgive and why to forgive. Ephesians 4, 31 and 32 says, you must put away every kind of bitterness, anger, wrath, quarreling, and evil, slanderous talk. Look at all these things. These are things that you could say about Joseph's brothers. Bitterness, anger, wrath, quarreling, evil, slanderous talk. He says, put them all away. And then in verse 32, he says, instead, be kind to one another, compassionate, forgiving one another, just as God in Christ also forgave you. Our forgiveness from God was not conditional. It's grace. And out of that grace, we're told to forgive, just like God forgave us. Another verse that I want to bring up, another couple verses, is Colossians 3, 12 and 13. Therefore, as the elect of God, holy and dearly loved, clothe yourselves with a heart of mercy, kindness, humility, gentleness, and patience, bearing with one another and forgiving one another. If someone happens to have a complaint against another, anyone else, just as the Lord has forgiven you, so you also forgive others. The Lord has forgiven you. If you've taken and received the gift of salvation from the Lord, He's forgiven you. And it's not just a, well, I see what you've done for me. It's a remission. Remission of sins because of the cross, because of the blood that was shed on the cross. And the picture that we're given is that just as Christ forgave us, God forgave us because of Christ, we're to go forgive each other. Our forgiveness doesn't get us or gain us forgiveness from God. It's an outflowing of God's forgiveness from us. That is grace, is that God motivated, He started it, and then He motivates us to follow Him, the picture that He gives us. Not because I want to gain merit in His sight, but because I've already gained the merit. God's already given me forgiveness. And out of that forgiveness, I need to forgive others. And if we're supposed to forgive just like God forgave us, we must understand how He forgave us. When Christ was on the cross, it says in Luke chapter 23, Christ was on the cross and there were people yelling out things. We sang How Deep the Father's Love, and you can almost hear your own voice calling out and yelling obscenities at Christ, right? Because that's what the crowd was doing, and very few of them didn't. But I could hear my voice shouting out. And you know what Christ said? Forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing. And He asked God, the Father, to forgive us, to forgive the people who were there, and to forgive us. That's the kind of forgiveness that we are to model, because He's given us that as an example. So I want you to take a look at that name. If you had a name written on that piece of paper, you don't have to show me that you did write a name, but you know if there's someone in your heart that you have to forgive. You know. You don't have to tell me. You know. God's calling you to forgive that person, or maybe group of people, maybe church, maybe work, maybe family. If God can forgive us while his son is hanging on the cross, dying, and the only thing he could say was, forgive them. No word of judgment towards us. No word of condemnation towards us, but forgive them. They know not what they're doing. Then we should be able to model that, to follow that example. We're not going to be perfect at it. But a first step would be to try to reconcile, bring you and the person back together and work through it with a heart of forgiveness.